from KQED.
This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Well, legendary surfer Kelly Slater clinched his 11th world championship yesterday in the Rip Curl Pro Search Contest at San Francisco's Ocean Beach. San Francisco is not exactly known as a surf town, but more than 2,000 fans braved the chilly conditions to watch the historic victory. Slater had apparently won the championship on Wednesday, but the title was declared invalid just 2 days later due to a calculation error, which he discovered. And we're going to get the latest on Rip Curl competition and on surfing, continuing today, by the way, that competition, discussed the Bay Area surfing scene. Joining us in studio is Daniel Duane, who's a journalist, an author, a surfer. His books include Caught Inside, A Surfer's Year on the California Coast, and his work has appeared in the New York Times, Men's Journal, and Outside, among other publications. Boy, I'm flipping over my words today. Anyway, Daniel, good to have you here. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
We also have Bruce Jenkins with us, sports columnist with the San Francisco Chronicle, who has been writing about this with a good deal of passion, I must say. Bruce, good to have you. Welcome.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, a lot of people wouldn't exactly think of Ocean Beach as a prime or optimal place to do anything with surfing, but it went pretty well, huh?
Well, yeah, it's going very well. I mean, despite probably the biggest gap I've ever seen in professional sports, having covered it for about 40 years, I mean, it's pretty incredible to crown someone the world champion and then just say, whoops, we miscalculated. I mean, it's a colossal mistake, but, you know, it's surfing and it moves on, and it's a nice day at the beach and everybody's happy, and Slater did win his world title, and now he's going to try to win the contest itself.
Well, explain a little bit for listeners why it was not crowned to him initially. What happened?
Well, the fact that the ASP could have miscalculated is really inconceivable. I mean, the previous contest ended in Portugal on October 18th. So,
excuse me, just for listeners' sake, Association of Surfing Professionals, ASP. Yeah,
the Association of Surfing Professionals, they have a tour. They call it the Dream Tour. It makes about a dozen stops. This is the 11th of the 12th. And the previous contest ended on the 18th of October, so considering that this opened on November 1st, they had more than enough time to make damn sure what the figures were and where Slater stood and what he needed to do to clinch the world title here. And we were told what he needed to do, and he did it, and they carried him up the beach and sprayed champagne on him, and everybody took photos, and there was a victory party. So later that night, Slater got online to read, you know, some of the accounts of his great win. He was reading the Surfline, which is one of the better internet surfing sites. And in the comments section, a guy named Mark is what they're still calling him because they still haven't been able to track him down. But a guy named Mark said, you know, I could be wrong, but it seems to me, if by my calculation, Slater hasn't won this thing. And this is where Slater, his real class came into play. He could have just said, well, you know, whatever, and moved on. But he took the guy to heart. He did the calculations himself over and over again and realized that, in fact, he was short of winning. And then he had to alert the ASP about it. And, of course, at first the ASP goes, oh, no, Kelly, you're fine. We're good. We got it right. Forget that. But, no, they were wrong, and they finally had to cop to their mistake. An unbelievable embarrassment. And a real testament to Slater, who couldn't live with himself by winning it unfairly.
Well, I think it was you who said that Slater may be, if you calculate just in terms of dominance in a sport, may be the greatest athlete of all time, if indeed surfing should be put in that category of professional sports and professional sport competition.
Well, the category is this, is long-term dominance being unquestionably the best. He won his first world title in 1992, 20 years ago, and now he's winning it again. And throughout that time, there's only been a 2 or 3 year period where anyone was considered his equal. That was the late Andy Irons, who won 3 world titles, a couple of which Slater really wasn't fully committed to the tour. And really, at no point during those 20 years, from a global perspective, has anyone thought that, you know, Slater has been the man. He's been the man in surfing for 20 years, just hands down, no questions asked. And I couldn't find anyone in any other sport who can say that.
Well, you know, Daniel Duane, there's been a lot of criticism by fans as well as by surfers of just the way the Association of Surfing Professionals operates, and this, I guess, brought a lot of it to a head. They say that the scoring and ranking is too complicated to begin with, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. It's sort of a goofy system. The pros sort of fly around the world as this sort of cabal of the top 44. They compete in these contests. The contests have many, many heats. The heats aren't, you know, there's different elimination systems. Sometimes two guys advance. Sometimes one guy advances. They're awarded a certain number of points, based on where they finish in a contest. And then the world title is awarded based on the accrual of points over that whole tour. And so every year there's this kind of calculation game going on of like, well, you know, Kelly's got this many points. And so, you know, for Kelly to win the title, he'll have to take at least third place at Reunion Island and then at least second. And Owen Wright will have to come in, you know, fourth. But if Owen comes in 11th, you know, then I mean, it's so arcane that I know very few people who actually keep track of that.
Like our last segment, they have to change the whole process, like with poverty census statistics. Yeah. But there's also been criticism. Bruce has written about this, kowtowing to sponsors, too much influence of the judges and the commentators, not compensating the surfers enough, and also selecting lousy locations, which a lot of people thought Ocean Beach would be.
Well, and this is, you know, that on the locations issue, I think you have to have some compassion for where the ASP organizers find themselves, which is that, you know, for many years that they did what one could consider an obvious thing, which is they put a lot of the tour contests in very populated, you know, very heavily populated areas, right? So that tons of people could come out and watch the thing. Huntington Beach in Southern California, for example. But the problem with populated areas is that these are not the places with the best waves in the world, right? So they were sort of sacrificing quality surf for crowds. And the internet, oddly, is what sort of liberated us from that, in the sense that as soon as you could have live web feeds, you didn't need to worry about the crowd on the beach, right? You didn't have to think of this thing as a spectator sport. And then you could start to have a crowd all over the world watching through the web. And that freed up the ASP to hold contests in very remote places that have the best waves in the world. This year, there was a contest in New York City, just outside New York City on Long Island. And then the one here, you know, you could think of those two contests as sort of nods to the old way. And, you know, it's a business. This is a for-profit business, so it's, you know.
But they always say about Ocean Beach, dirty, deadly, and foggy.
Dirty, deadly, and foggy. Ocean Beach is a very, very unusual and very special surf spot. And it's not, in some ways it wasn't, it was a bad choice for a surf contest in that it is so unpredictable. The way in which it wasn't a bad choice is that there's always surf here of some kind. And it can be, at times, extraordinarily good and powerful.
Talk about good and powerful. This is really big. I mean, watching, observing surfing, and just doing it as well, much more than I think most people realize. And it seems to be growing, doesn't it?
Well, and that's part of that internet phenomenon, that web phenomenon, in the sense, in that way in which the web allows niche activities to find everybody in the world who is interested in that niche and aggregate them into what turns into a colossal audience. So this is really the way in which the web was sort of the killer app for, you know, for pro surf. It was the thing that made pro surfing happen.
I'm wondering, those of you who are listening, if you were there at Ocean Beach, if you saw the spectacle and drama, you may want to join us, or if you've done some surfing. And of course, always when you talk about surfing, the big question comes up about what about sharks? I'd like to hear from some surfers and hear particularly from those who've had experience that may have been changed, as Daniel Duane was saying, because of this killer app, so to speak, and the whole nature of the internet and how it has altered. You can join us, and you certainly can feel free to join us now at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. If you're listening to us beyond the Bay Area, in fact, you may want to join as well just to talk about surfing from your perspective wherever you are. It's 866-733-6786. Does surfing and the surfing competition professionally get you psyched? Like I say, there are a couple thousand people out there at Ocean Beach. It was a major event. You may want to let us know what you think or raise your questions or comments by emailing us. You can do that as well, forum@kqed.org, or post a question or comment on our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment or go to our Facebook page and let us know what your thoughts are or questions or comments. Talking to Daniel Duane, who is journalist, author, surfer, author of Caught Inside, A Surfer's Year on the California Coast, and who has had his work appear in the New York Times, Men's Journal, and Outside, and with Bruce Jenkins, sports columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle, who's been following this. And what about the shark factor, Bruce?
Well, you know, Dan and I have both been Ocean Beach regulars for years, and I know Dan will get a kick out of this. In the first round, a Hawaiian surfer named Dusty Payne was absolutely certain that he saw a shark out here, completely freaked out and came to the beach and just blew off his heat in a chance to to win the event. The next day I was out down at Noriega, and I ran into Kevin Starr, who's been surfing out here for many, many years. And he said that he got together with Mark Reniker and a couple other guys. Probably between them, they've got about 100 years of experience out here, and none of them have ever seen a shark. I've seen sharks once in my life, but never out here. I don't know about you, Dan, but it's certainly not common at Ocean Beach.
I'm actually more shocked to hear that Kevin Starr is a surfer. I mean, you know, talk about surprises.
You're thinking surfer. Of the late
maybe
California
a different
historian.
Kevin Starr.
Yeah,
yeah,
that's a different Kevin.
Yeah, that's who I was thinking of, of course. Have you seen any sharks, Daniel?
I have never seen a shark in all my years of surfing this coast. I have, however, had a very similar experience to that pro surfer. In other words, there was a day I was out at a spot and I saw a fin, and I was absolutely 100% certain it was a shark. And I said to the guys I was with, "Oh, I just saw a shark." And we all turned around and we paddled all the way to the beach in about 3 seconds flat. And we turned around and looked back out, and one of the guys said, "You know, there was a sea lion out there sort of holding its flipper up. Could it have been that?" And I thought about it and said, "Yeah, I think that's probably what I saw now that I think about it." And yet the fear is so profound that there was no humiliation around this. Nobody said, "Oh, you idiot, you got us out of the water." It was just kind of like, "Oh, okay. All right."
Does it raise the adrenaline level and make things more exciting? I mean, it's a spectator sport, I'm thinking, as opposed to maybe a participant.
Does it raise the adrenaline of the spectator?
Of the spectator thinking, you know, a shark could come.
No, the truth is
it's so remote and so unlikely.
Percentage.
Yeah.
That, you know, that's like hanging out waiting for rock climbers to get hit by lightning or something. You know, it's too.
Yeah, I was going to say I've had many occasions. I'm a body surfer, so the surfers are always getting on me as being sort of the appetizer, or you know, or maybe the entree. Where I've seen a fin, and I'm like, "Oh God!" But it's just a dolphin. That's happened so many times, and that's invariably what it turns out to be. But if someone gets freaked out, like you say, there's no humiliation involved. If that's what's going on in your mind, you get out of there. And the one time I saw one down in Montana, I got out of the water so fast it was like a cartoon. The adrenaline was running pretty good.
And a buddy of ours, a guy Bruce knows, and also that a guy named August Hidalgo, mm-hmm. who's an Ocean Beach regular. He's also a Mavericks regular, and Mavericks is the big wave spot just south of Ocean Beach. He was circled by a great white within the last month.
Where, and this was at Ocean Beach?
It was at Mavericks.
Oh, at Mavericks. I'm sorry, you said
south of here, but yeah.
We were hoping to get Kelly Slater on here this morning, but he's in the water. He was willing to talk, but too bad. Let's go to our callers in the meantime. Lots of people want to talk. And Reed, you're up first. Good morning.
Yeah, hi. My name's Reed. I live near Ocean Beach in San Francisco. And in fact, I learned to surf in exactly the spot where the tournament is taking place. And my very first time, I paddled out and I made it outside, which is not easy there. And I saw a dorsal fin in the water and freaked out and started paddling in, but saw another surfer just sitting there placidly. And I asked him about the dorsal fin, and he said, "It's a dolphin." And sure enough, it was a dolphin. And I was surfing there just 2 days ago and saw a whole pod swim by. So I'm guessing that's what Dusty Payne may have seen, similar or perhaps a seal.
Yeah.
Yeah. The thing is, it goes from fear to euphoria. I mean, it's wonderful to see dolphins. And it's quite a shift in mood there.
And the second thing is even in the conditions yesterday, which were not good at all, Kelly, after his heat, caught the unbelievable two ride that actually Dan, I thought, did a great job of writing about. So I was with my friend, who's a surfer, even more experienced, much more experienced than me, and we were watching the tube ride, and he was in the tube, and we both wanted him to make it through, but we turned to each other, realizing that there's no way he was going to make it through this closing out wave that was, you know, crumbling in on top of him. And we even had the time to comment, "Oh, man, too bad he didn't make it out." And then, bam, he makes it out, and the crowd went nuts. And I watched the highlight of it on the surf line, on the surf web feed this morning, and the cameraman even gave up on him. So as far
really
as I know, only the people there saw him make it out of that tube.
That was really an amazing thing to see. You saw it, Dan, yeah.
I did, and I also, before I comment, I wanted to say one thing about last thing about the shark, which is we should all like it's worth saying we don't know what that guy saw, and he may well have seen a shark. It's just important to say that, but just because we don't want to cast aspersions on him and say he's a really experienced surfer from Hawaii and all that. Anyway, but The tube, I spoke this morning to Matt Warshaw, the author of the Encyclopedia of Surfing and the History of Surfing, who is a dear friend and a longtime Ocean Beach surfer who has probably spent more time in the barrel than anybody else at Ocean Beach. He's sort of a tube fiend. One day he surfed for 9 straight hours on a particularly hollow day at Ocean Beach, and I think we calculated he must have gotten about 60 barrels that day. And he was just sort of jaw-dropping, dumbfounded that Kelly came out of that barrel. No, I mean, what I'm trying to say is nobody knows the Ocean Beach barrel better than Matt does. And the thing was crumbling. It was ugly. It was falling apart. It looked like a closeout. Anyway, that's sort of...
Well, that's greatness. Let's go to Berkeley. Sean, join us. You're on.
Hi. I just wanted to chime in and comment. You know, I grew up in Southern California around Malibu. Grew up surfing, started when I was around 12, and moved up to the Bay Area in 2004 for college. And first time I went out in Ocean Beach after 10 years of surfing, I literally couldn't make it out and got punished and pushed all the way back to shore and pretty much had to relearn how to surf up here just because of the power of the wave. But once I did, I found that the soul and spirit of surfing in San Francisco was way more impactful and meaningful than any of the places I've surfed in Southern California or even Hawaii, where people think surfing is much more popular.
Well, let's talk about that. In fact, Bruce Jenkins can't help. I was singing Beach Boys this morning. We get a little music like Surfing's What I Want, getting bigger every day from Hawaii to the shores of Peru. I mean, it's certainly international, but it has its own qualities in each area, in each region. What's distinct here and what's better here and what's maybe worse here?
Well, that's interesting. I'm from Malibu, too. I grew up surfing Malibu in the 50s and 60s before I came up to Cal. And the difference between the two regions is really striking. I mean, almost every surf spot down there, especially now, is heavily populated. There's a lot of localism, a lot of stress and backbiting and yelling and sometimes violence. And you get up here to Ocean Beach, and you've got 2 miles of beach break just going off, and you pick your spot. Like you said, it takes forever to get out. There have been days when some of us, all of us, just can't get out. You're just driven back to the beach, and somehow even that is a satisfying experience just because you did it. But it's a very solitary thing. You can paddle out with somebody, and within 10 minutes, you can't find him, and you never will find him. He's down the beach, he's in the current, and he's gone. And I really enjoy that aspect of it. You know, it's really just about you and the waves, and unless it's super crowded in one particular spot, you don't really have those interactions with other people. It's all about you and the waves.
Well, here's a listener who writes on our website, a listener named Catherine, who was born and brought up in Hawaii. How nice it would be if for once a program about surfing included the achievements of women surfers, routinely subjugated by tournament stature, media attention, endorsements, and prize monies. Women surfers are equally athletic, agile, and attention-getting in the water as their male counterparts. The ongoing inequity is pathetic, given that waves care not about gender, but about only ability. And she makes a good point here, but we did a show on women surfers a few years ago. By the way, you can check our archives. It's in there. They do get more attention, though, don't they, Bruce? The men, I mean?
Well, they do. And, you know, it really all comes down to the big wave arena, I think. You know, places like Pipeline and Waimea and Chopu and Tahiti and Jaws on Maui. You know, these are the spots that everyone turns to when the waves are big and they want to know who's surfing out there, who's making news, who's helping the sport evolve. And inevitably that has been men. There are more women in the big wave surfing arena now than ever before, but there's probably only, I don't know, maybe 6 women that are really, really doing it in big ways consistently and have a name that people recognize. Maybe that means women are just smarter than men because we've lost a lot of good men in big waves. But in the general surfing arena, the women's surfing is absolutely off the charts. I go to Hawaii every year and I'm absolutely blown away by the talent. Everywhere you go, women are just completely going off. And I think just for people who enjoy the sport and know what's happening, I think there is a measure of equality there.
What about here, Daniel Duane, in this area, in Ocean Beach and so on?
Well, so, you know, I really appreciate this comment from the listener because I have 2 little girls and I have 2 daughters, ages 6 and 9. And just
this, budding surfers, are they?
Yeah. I sure hope so, yeah. I got them both standing up on surfboards this summer for the first time. But they, just this morning before I came in here, I was watching the heats and my littlest one was watching with me and really excited. And then she said, are there any women? And it really kind of zapped me because I realized I was sort of talking about world tour, world champion, world title without differentiating this is the men's world title and over here is the women's world title. And I was talking about it as if it were just the world title. And so then, you know, I clicked through and very quickly found the ASP Women's World Tour website and we watched Carissa Moore winning a heat in France and all that. But there has been an enormous change that I'm happy to see because partly because I'm a father of girls, which is that when I started surfing around here, let's say 20 plus years ago, it was really quite uncommon to see women in the water. And when you did, everyone's head would turn, and it's not uncommon at all anymore. It's just part of the landscape.
Yeah, what about? Say, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Bruce Jenkins.
Yeah. No, I have a 12-year-old daughter, and I've been amazed at the opportunities girls have and boys to surf competitively. We have surf clubs. There's surf teams in the high school and middle school. They're always having these competitions up and down the beach, girls included. The total equality in place. And you know, geez, when I was a kid, that didn't exist at all. I mean, really, for girls in any sport. I mean. And so the venue is there, the opportunity is there, and I see all these girls, 12, 13, 14, that are so into it, and they're getting so good, and it's really promising.
And again, Bruce Jenkins is sports columnist with the San Francisco Chronicle. Here's a listener named Clint giving some testimony. He says, I'm a 47-year-old California native. I've always lived near the ocean and was really awestruck by this Rip Curl event. I've never surfed or been that interested, but I heard about the event, took the last Tuesday afternoon off to see and check it out. Crowds were great. I saw Kelly Slater win the first time on one of the warmest days of the beach I can remember. I have been so excited about the event now that I took my partner out to watch again yesterday. And here's another listener who says, not to diminish the accomplishments of Kelly Slater, but how about Gordie Howe?
Well, Gordie Howe, yeah. Gordie Howe played hockey for, I think, 78 years. Not quite, but he was...
That was Satchel Paige in baseball, I think.
Gordie Howe played professional hockey well into his 40s. But just in terms of the Slater thing... He did not have a 20-year period where there was absolutely no question that he was the best player in hockey. You could say that about Wayne Gretzky. I mean, you can bring up dozens of names. I've heard from, you know, people about race car drivers and bowlers and kayakers and, you know, crew. And there's always people like this. But just for that whole 20-year solid dominance, that's where Slater stands alone, I think.
The other piece of that is just how far above the crowd he stands. And is another thing I was talking about this morning with Warshaw, who's my sensei on all this.
How about Bobby Fischer in chess, maybe?
Now there's a dangerous sport right there.
So Matt was pointing out that if you divide Slater's career in half, in other words, if you just take all of his winnings, break them in half, and assign them to person A and person B, he's still the first and best surfer of all time. And if you break it into thirds, he is still the first, second, and third best surfer of all time in terms of winnings.
And he comes across, as you've written, as a pretty humble guy. And now whether how much of that is an act or not, I don't know, but it's certainly contrasted to Andy Irons, who was, in fact, the next caller who's listening to us on Sirius in Puerto Rico has something to say about Andy Irons. Joe, go ahead. You're on.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Listen, I just know here you guys all talking about surfing. You were talking about some of the possible dangers of it. Last year, unfortunately, when Kelly Slater won his 10th world championship, like I mentioned earlier, Andy Irons unfortunately fell ill, and the world was given the news that he died of dengue fever. It turns out later that was not the case. Unfortunately, he was it was a drug overdose. But it's sad to know that, you know, the whole world heard about, you know, surfing in Puerto Rico based on the mosquito that killed one of the best surfers in the world. So just to clarify to everybody, dengue fever did not kill Andy Irons. And more importantly, Puerto Rico, no passport required. We got the best waves in the Caribbean. Come check us out.
All right. Thank you. Works for the Puerto Rican Chamber of Commerce, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, there he was.
And here's Stephen from Daly City. Stephen, join us. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you fine.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I've been pretty much surfing Ocean Beach since about 1980. I'm 56 years old. I love Ocean Beach. It's a great spot. Back up until about 96 or 97, there really wasn't heavy crowds here at all. I mean, I used to try to look for people to surf with sometimes, you know. But now I just recently sold my house here in San Francisco. I live in Southeast Asia. And on my way there, I go to Hawaii. And in regards to Kelly Slater, I think he's the best surfer in the world, hands down. But I had a conversation with him the other day, and he was telling me, like when I go to Hawaii, I stay with Buttons Kia Keikalani, and he was telling me how he really has admired Buttons' surfing exposure to it, and that he really envies Buttons, too, in the sense that he's the guy that actually originated doing 360s in the tube and stuff like that. And I just wanted to make that comment. You know, Ocean Beach is a beautiful spot.
I'm glad you made the comment, and I thank you for it. And what about crowds in general, Daniel Duane? I mean, say Half Moon Bay, for example, different places around here.
So, right. So the crowd issue at Ocean Beach, the thing that keeps down the crowds at Ocean Beach is that it's a hard paddle. There are these sort of relentless walls of white water, and there really are not big, obvious openings between them to paddle out. So just to get from the beach to where the good waves are breaking, particularly on a big good day, can take – sometimes it's not so bad, but it can take 45 minutes of relentless all-out physical effort. And I once calculated that I think I had to duck under 160 waves. I was just sort of doing the math based on the wave period and how long it took me. That I had to duck under 160 waves just to get out to where the waves were breaking. And this can be – I mean, it keeps you in good shape and all that, and it's sort of exciting. But it can be really dispiriting. You know, I mean, 45 minutes, an hour of all-out effort, and you finally get out there, and you're just physically destroyed. And then you get one wave to the beach, and you have to do it all over again. So that has a way of keeping the crowds down.
Oh, what about the crowds as you see it, Bruce Jenkins?
Well, I could not put it any better than Dan just did. I mean, as I was saying, you can say there's four of you and you hit the water in the same place on one of the avenues, and with all the chaos and mayhem that can happen to you, maybe one guy gets out and all he hits that little window. He's just a little ahead of you. He gets out there and he's got a dream session coming up, but the rest of you were just a little bit inside. You got nailed by that wave, and now you've got, you know, another 50, 60. Yeah, I love 160. That's just an awesome thing. And I know Dan's not exaggerating there. But once again, it's not really about the crowds here. Sometimes you'll get out there, and there are quite a few guys out, and it's a little harder to get your way. But at the same time, you can always just head down to the next peak. Maybe it's not as good. But if you want solitude, you can find it. And that's very rare in surfing these days.
Bruce, we got seconds left. What are we going to see now in terms of this ongoing event?
Slater is about to surf his quarterfinal. This is all two-man heats from now on. If he wins the quarterfinal, we'll get to the semifinals and then the final. It should be done by about 1 o'clock today, so we're winding down here.
We'll continue to watch. Thank you, Bruce Jenkins. Thank you, Daniel Duane. And thank you, our listeners. Another hour of Forum ahead. We're going to meet Nobel Prize-winning economist who's a psychologist. Daniel Kahneman will be joining us in studio to talk about his new book, Thinking Fast and Slow. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.